It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about ice climbing. You've probably seen climbers making their way up the waterfalls along the Seward Highway. And if you're like me, you might think the sport looks a bit crazy. Who would want to brave the cold and dangerous ice to make it to the top of a waterfall? Well, today we're going to get the inside scoop on what motivates ice climbers in Alaska, where the best spots to climb are, and some history of the sport in the state. To join the conversation, call 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 outside Anchorage, or on Facebook, Outdoor Explorer. And with me today are two very experienced climbers, Carl Tobin and Matt Sundy. Carl has been climbing in Alaska since the 1970s and has dozens of first ascents to his name. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Annie.
And Matt Sundy is an avid climber who is a guide and owner at Ascending Path, a guide service based in Anchorage. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
And while my guests have ice climbed for decades, I had never even tried the sport before the producer asked me to host this show. So I decided to get at least a small taste of what it's all about. My friend Joe Stock, an international climbing guide, agreed to take me out last month.
Looks like there's some fun devil's club yet here.
Proper Alaska climbing if there's Devil's Club.
Okay. I've always been skeptical of ice climbing. It seems cold and dangerous. But until I was following Joe up a steep hill to the base of our climb, I didn't realize I should have been worried about Devil's Club, too.
I almost just got it in the eye there.
We finally make it to a flat spot at the base of a waterfall of ice coming down a steep cliff. The ice has a lacy quality to it, so it's called Victoria's Secret. It's just a few minutes off the Seward Highway behind Potter's Marsh.
So first of all, let's put on our helmets.
Joe says helmets are always the first priority.
Just like always with ice climbing, you've got to watch out for any blocks that'll break off and just stay clear of those.
Is that the biggest danger?
Yeah, things falling on your head, yeah. Yeah, it's not a safe sport. Just like any backcountry sport is not safe, but we just try to reduce the hazards and do it with as much safety as possible.
So is it like the least safe sport?
No, it's base jumping for sure. It's probably like 100 times safer than base jumping.
With that reassuring thought and our helmets securely attached to our heads, Joe helps me get suited up. I put on a harness and he helps me attach crampons to my boots.
Okay, there we go. That's a snap we're after.
Joe scrambles up a lower angle waterfall with his crampons and ice axes and secures the climbing rope to a tree at the top of the climb. He's back on the ground so quickly, I hardly have time to get nervous. Then it's time for a demonstration. He walks up to the waterfall, offering advice along the way, like keep your heels down and your arms shoulder width apart.
So I get my feet in a good position here, and I swing into the concavity. And there, just stuck straight in. But you'll notice if I swing into this convexity, into this bulge right here, the ice will smack. It'll break up.
Oh, wow.
It's just gonna smash apart.
Okay.
Joe also keeps telling me to relax, which I'm finding it harder and harder to do, especially as he ties me into the rope, checks me over, and tells me I'm good to go.
You're on belay and ready to climb.
Okay.
I immediately forget all of Joe's advice, but I slowly make my way up to the lower angle waterfall and tentatively start climbing. With Joe yelling encouragement from below, I swing my axe into the ice, and after a few tries, it sticks.
Okay.
One axe placement at a time, I make my way to the top. Joe lowers me down, and I breathe a sigh of relief. To me, the climb seems extreme. But at the bottom, Joe politely informs me it's a level 2, just one step above a flat pond. Still, as a newbie, it was a fun adventure. And Joe says that's what ice climbing in Alaska is all about.
If you just want to go ice climbing, you go to Colorado. Because Colorado, you can go to this place called Ouray in southwest Colorado, and you can walk to the base of 200 climbs with your coffee cup. And it's just like you get there and there's climb after climb after climb. Here you got to go through hours of Devil's Club and you got to freeze and it's dark or it's raining or something like that. It's a big adventure up here.
And if you want to see a short video of Joe Stock teaching some ice climbing techniques, go to alaskapublic.org. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and our topic today is ice climbing. I'm Annie Feit. My guests are two experienced ice climbers, Carl Tobin and Matt Sundy. And what do you guys think about what Joe said at the end there? Is it a fair assessment to say it's a big adventure, climbing, ice climbing Alaska? Carl?
I think he's pretty right about that. There are some places where the ice is close to the road, you know, Seward Highway, Keystone Canyon and Valdez, but you're in for a day of it. I'm a little shaken after Joe said base jumping's dangerous. I've been thinking of doing one of those things.
Really?
Yeah, but that's another topic. Come on, Joe.
And Matt, what about you? What do you think? It's a big adventure?
Yeah, it's always an adventure in Alaska to do anything in the wilderness. You just need to be prepared and sort of really be adaptable and be knowledgeable about where you're going and what you're in for.
Okay, well, if you have your own ice climbing adventure to share or questions about the sport, call 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 outside Anchorage, or you can ask a question on Facebook, search Outdoor Explorer. And let's start by talking about exactly what ice climbing is. Most listeners are probably more familiar with rock climbing. So, Matt, how does it compare to rock climbing?
Well, you know, when you're learning ice climbing, it's pretty similar in how you learn rock climbing, and you wear some of the same equipment, a harness and the same kind of rope. But for ice climbing, you've got typically, in Alaska at least, plastic mountaineering boots that are insulated and rigid, and then a good pair of rigid crampons for your feet. And then for your tools to swing, nowadays are nice high-tech curved ice climbing tools that are different from a mountaineering ice axe. And the way we teach ice climbing is typically the guide or instructor will set up a top rope setup, which is very similar to what you see in a climbing gym.
Okay. And is it mostly waterfalls or are there other opportunities for ice climbing? I mentioned waterfalls, but I assume that's not all.
Right, that's correct. I mean, 90% of our sort of volume of folks, new beginners we take out climbing is, well, I'd say 70% is in the summer on glaciers. So we take folks to various glaciers to top rope ice, and you know, you could do that in a t-shirt in Alaska in the summer.
And Carl, is there anything you want to add to the sort of the difference between ice climbing and rock climbing?
Well, I'm more focused on the similarities, I think, because they're both ways of ascending features. And sometimes you'll find that your ice climbing, at least in my experience, and if it's thin ice, you start using more rock climbing moves. And occasionally, oh, I can grab that if I just drop my tool, and you'll be using your hands. You know, the setup on your feet stays the same, though. You know, the crampons, you don't take your crampons off very often, but sometimes even that helps.
And it does look crazy. So I don't know who wants to start here, but explain why anybody would want to do this sport.
You know, I think, honestly, that's one of the oldest questions that climbers get is, you know, why do you go climb something? Well, you know, I think my answer, anyone who knows me knows, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, but essentially there's some sort of really addictive, powerful change that happens to you when you're totally in the moment on something really scary or doing something, putting your body in a really intense place where your consequences are high. There's a huge reward to that, and maybe it's biochemical, maybe it's, you know, hormonal, but there is something super powerful about being totally present and being really in a place where your actions affect your consequence. And so that translates to be fun for us, whether it's powder skiing or maybe hitting a tennis ball in the perfect way or whatever sport it is for you. Anyone who sort of tries climbing, I think they can get a sense of the awe that is engineered through this activity.
And does ice climbing kind of offer a different level of that than the other sports you mentioned, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's also sort of a gateway sport to mountaineering. I mean, it used to be ice climbing was practice for the big mountains, and now it's become a sport in itself. And to a large degree, a lot of climbers love just the process of doing the moves of climbing and just really just being present. So it's not really about getting to the top of something the way mountaineering sort of used to be. It's really about the present or the process.
And Carl, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think I'd agree. It was a gateway into mountaineering, just like rock climbing was a gateway into mountaineering for so many climbers. And certainly me being older and having started ice climbing in the 70s, it was a way to gain more skill in the mountains from my point of view. But it wasn't long until it took on its own reason for doing it. And I started looking around for first ascents and new ice climbs to do in Alaska, along with mountaineering, because it's a great activity. And I don't think it is that unsafe, particularly today. I've seen it be unsafe. When I started ice climbing without a helmet, and one day I got hit in the head with a big old dinner plate of ice and yelled up to my partner, I'm okay, and then the blood started gushing all over my face, and I changed my mind about being okay. But I was okay. But you know, the whole setup of helmets and new protection, if the ice is good, you know, that's the deal. Sometimes the medium itself isn't so good, but the equipment is great these days.
Okay, and I want to get more into the risks later, but can you talk about just how you got into the sport in the 1970s?
I don't know. In the winter in Fairbanks, it's if it's 50 below, it's really useful to go to Valdez where it's 10 or 20 above. It's almost like going to Hawaii, really. And the lure of those big ice climbs down there that hardly anyone had touched was very, very strong.
And was the sport in the U.S., was it kind of developing at that time, or was it kind of describe what was going on?
It was developing in that time. I think one of the better-known ice climbs in the lower 48 is Bridalveil Falls in Telluride. And I think that was first ascended in 1975, free solo, by the way. Some of the other larger ice climbs in Canada were starting to be picked off at about that time. And in Alaska, we were inspired by that and tried to emulate our models from the real climbing world.
So did you just know Valdez had good ice, or how did you end up there?
I don't know if I'd heard rumors about the ice there. That was certainly before Andrew Embick moved there and started motivating local climbing. But I had worked in marine science doing some sampling and had been down to the arm in the winter to do some sampling before the pipeline started working, you know, to see what might get wrecked, if something would get wrecked down there, which it did. And I noticed all the climbs in Keystone, you know, driving in and out of there a few times, and thought I should come back here.
So is it right off the highway, or?
Right off the highway, okay. It, on the approach to town as you go through along the Low River on Keystone Canyon. It's easily the most accessible big and serious climbing in Alaska.
Okay, so that kind of was your gateway into the sport?
Yeah.
Is that where you started to love ice climbing?
No, I think that was around Healy, just south of Healy, the Fox Creek and Dragonfly Creeks, these small creeks with 60 or 70-foot waterfalls in them. You'd have to hike up a canyon and or down a canyon in case of Dragonfly. And we would drive down there weekend after weekend to go climbing.
Okay, and we do have a caller, Clint. You're on the air. What did you want to ask?
Hey, Carl, this question's for you. This is Clint Helander.
Thought so.
Hey, Carl. I was just wondering how, like, when you go back and repeat a climb like Lowie Sowie that you did back in 1980 or whenever, and you do it today, how does it feel to repeat that climb with modern gear? And do you feel like some of the bite has been taken out of the climb?
Let's see. I've done Lowie Sowie three times, probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 years apart each time. The first time was a mental push just to get on it.
And why don't you explain what Wowie Zowie is for those of us who don't?
It's an iconic climb in Mineral Creek Canyon, right up behind Valdez. When we first saw it, when we did the first ascent of Bridalveil Falls, we were crashing out in Mineral Creek Canyon and woke up one morning and saw it way up the canyon, and we said, Wowie Zowie. And that's how it got its name.
That's awesome.
And it's as a full on pure ice climb, it's quite steep. But every time I've climbed it, it's been different. Sometimes steeper, sometimes not. Sometimes hard, difficult ice. Sometimes plastic ice. So I think the conditions, even with modern tools, the change in ice conditions can make anything a bit of a somewhat scary, or maybe you'd be more cautious, and other times not. I ought to go climb that thing again, actually.
When was the last time you climbed it?
I'm thinking 10 years ago or something like that.
Okay.
Not sure, really.
Yeah. And Matt, why don't you describe how you got into the sport?
Well, I didn't start in Valdez, which is pretty much the best place in the world probably to start ice climbing. I started in a rock gym, you know, in Pennsylvania, where I was in high school, just learned rock climbing there, and then got out looking for adventure, basically, with friends. And in the winter, we needed stuff to do, so we got into ice climbing in Pennsylvania, and that was, you know, more than 20 years ago.
And then how did you end up in Alaska and end up climbing here as well?
Well, it evolved. I mean, it was all things climbing, so I was big into rock climbing, and that evolved into ice climbing, which evolved into mountaineering and alpinism, and then that really took me places. So I would go travel to go climb, and figured out that I could make a living as a guide to go to these great places and share it with other people. Essentially, I came up to Alaska in 1998 to climb Denali, and walked in from Talkeetna my first year. And we had great weather and just got hooked on Alaska.
And then from there, moved up here and started branching out, climbing different things?
Yeah, I started Ascending Path in 1995, right out of college, or sort of during college. And then met my wife on Denali, or my to-be wife, Heather, and we put some energy into the business down in Girdwood in about 2001 and started really developing it as a guide service.
Well, as a guide and the owner of a guide service, what advice do you have for people that want, you know, are interested in ice climbing and want to get into it?
Well, it obviously makes sense to go with either people who really know what they're doing, or hire an instructor or guide who can really help teach you the basics, the fundamentals, so that you learn from the bottom up. That makes sense. That's intuitive. But I think what really makes sense is to just sort of get out and go for an adventure on your own while being prepared. So sort of study up, do your due diligence, get the right gear, the right knowledge, and then go out and get after it and try to have a good time and learn from experience.
And is that mostly your clientele? Are they beginners, or are they?
Yeah, we have a lot of beginners. We have a lot of folks who are rock climbers who want to try ice climbing and see if they want to get into it. Our business now is structured for more visitors from out of state in the summer. But we get a lot of Alaskans who just want to learn ice climbing.
Okay, and we are talking about ice climbing on Outdoor Explorer today. If you have your own ice climbing story that you want to talk about, or a question for one of the guests who are both really experienced ice climbers, call 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 outside of Anchorage. You can ask a question on our Facebook page. Just search Outdoor Explorer there. And Matt, how do you have a sense of how much the sport is growing in Alaska?
Well, I think it's fairly self-limiting as far as growth goes. But yeah, there's a lot more popularity. I think the climbing gear companies have been producing new equipment, which has made it maybe more affordable and easier for people to get a hold of gear that you need to go ice climbing with. But yeah, there seems to be quite a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about ice climbing in Alaska.
And are the most popular climbs getting more crowded, or how can you?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, we try to be very sensitive to that as a guide service too, by trying to stay off some of the more popular climbs during weekends and that sort of thing. But ultimately, yeah, it's great to see people in the wilderness exploring and adventuring, because that's, I think, good for everybody.
And what are the best, like, most accessible places near Anchorage to climb?
Well, the Chugach, the Chugach offers lots of different climbing options. North of Anchorage, there's a variety of different, climbing areas. And then south, we've got the Seward Highway and Portage, and in the Chugach National Forest. Portage Valley has a ton of great climbing options as well. But, each particular area has its own issues as far as, avalanche hazard in Portage, for example, makes for better to early season climbs, November, December time of year. And then farther north, they just have a different climate. So there's just a variety of different places depending on what the weather's doing.
And how about you, Carl? Where do you like to go?
Well, I've gotten way into mixed climbing. And so I look for places that have less ice than most people might want on a climb, and in some cases, very little.
And by mixed, so, you're saying it's both a rock climbing and...
Yeah, it's a mixture of rock and ice, but you're climbing it as if you were ice climbing. It's winter climbing. Obviously, when it's zero, bare hands don't cut it anyway. It's nice to have some big, thick, warm boots on. And mixed climbing has taken off in a lot of venues around the country and around Europe. So I've been, for several years, since I started working at Alaska Pacific, first year there, I got a notion of some ice on the north face of Ptarmigan Peak and found it and went and climbed it and noticed that there are little patches and touches of ice connected by crack systems or whatever, and just kept going up there. Almost got addicted to it. And it's, the approach is hard, and the climbing's hard, but safe. I've taken a number of leader falls up there and walked away smoothly, or continued to keep trying the problem. It's a good area.
Describe what a leader fall is.
It's when you're the first up on a climb. Putting some pro in when you can get it, maybe every once in a while, and you fall. And you free fall until you go twice the distance plus the rope stretch past your last piece of protection, if it holds. And if it's good pro, it'll hold. That's another thing about modern climbing equipment. The protection's sweet.
It's gotten a lot better.
A lot better. Not perfect, of course. Depends on the medium you're sticking it in.
Okay, and we have another caller who I think wants to address this topic. Reed, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been climbing around here for about 22, 23 years, and I've never been injured. And I don't know if it's just luck or what, but it can be done safely. It's a lot of fun.
So what's your secret?
Don't push it. If you get into a bad situation, back out. Don't push it. It never gets better. And my wife's name is Heather also.
And did you have a response, Matt?
Luck is a huge part of it, I think. I mean, ultimately, it is a dangerous activity. And if you can manage the risk properly, maybe you can pull off a career or, a whole life of climbing without any injuries. But I think statistically, I think you're an anomaly. Ice climbers, I think a lot of ice climbers, if they pull off 20 years of climbing, they're going to have several injuries to talk about and or accidents that they've seen and been around. And so I applaud that you haven't been hurt. It's a good sign.
Okay, and I definitely want to talk more about risk management in the second part of the show, but now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar.
tomorrow, March 15th through the 19th, the Kenai Board of Game will meet at the Kenai Cultural Center for its South Central Region meeting to adopt regulation changes dealing with the use of taking of game, including statewide reauthorization of antlerless moose hunts and brown bear tag fee exemptions. Meeting materials and a live audio stream of the meeting will be available. Ski all night at Kincaid. Scan 24, a 24-hour ski race, is coming up next weekend, Saturday, March 23rd, at Kincaid Park in Anchorage. You may race solo, as a duo, quad relay, or eight-person relay team. There's also a 12-hour and 6-hour event. Registration for Scan 24 closes on March 20th. Wednesday, March 27th, there's a free fire-building course in Anchorage. Students will be instructed and challenged to build fires with minimal gear and all-natural materials. Students will also be introduced to primitive fire-building skills. For links to more info on these events, go to alaskapublic.org. Finally, the 13th annual Usyk Classic Ski Race Tour is this Saturday, March 16th in Talkeetna. To tell us a little bit more about this year's race, we have Denali Ski Club President Chris Mannix on the phone. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Annie. How's it going?
Good. So describe the Usyk for us.
The race or the object?
let's stick with the race.
Okay. Well, it's sort of a fun event. It's not a race in the sense that some races are highly competitive. It's a race tour, and our trails up here are not always groomed to the high standards that skiers see in maybe Anchorage and Fairbanks. It's more of a it's a throwback to simpler times in Nordic skiing.
What is the course like this year?
This year we have chosen to put the course out on our three rivers, the Talkeetna, the Susitna, and the Tulitna rivers. And people up here look forward to spring skiing on the rivers. It's one of those things that you feel sometimes as if you're skiing all winter to get prepared for spring skiing on the rivers. And also in the back of our minds is the thought that someday the state may want to dam the Susitna River, and skiing out there may not be a possibility. So we just thought we'd give people the opportunity to get out on the rivers and enjoy them. I was out yesterday, and it was absolutely beautiful. Just, almost 360-degree views of the Alaska Range and the Talkeetna Mountains, and it was just it's beautiful out there.
And you mentioned the name Usyk has a story behind it. Do you want to describe that?
Oh, well, the Usyk is it's the baculum of the male walrus. And years ago when the race got started, Adam Verrier, a former Olympic skier, was trying to figure out how to have a fun race where people could get together and ski and dance and party. And I guess it was Zach Steer up at Sheep Mountain Lodge who had this Usyk lying around and gave it to Adam and said, something to the effect of, well, here's the symbol for your race. And Adam took it and flew with it. And now that Usyk is mounted on a plaque, and the winners of the 50-kilometer event get their names, men and women get their names put on the plaque. And that plaque is up here in Talkeetna.
Okay. Well, thanks, Chris, for talking with me.
Okay. Thanks for showing an interest.
Chris Mannix is president of the Denali Ski Club. I'm your host, Annie Feit. Stay with us for the second half of the show on ice climbing when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. If you're listening in the evening, it is a recorded rebroadcast and will not be taking phone calls. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and our topic today is ice climbing. I'm Annie Feit, and my guests are two very experienced ice climbers. We have Carl Tobin in the studio and Matt Sundy. If you want to join the conversation, if you have a question for either of these two, or a story to share about your own ice climbing adventures, call 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 outside of Anchorage. On Facebook, you can search Outdoor Explorer and ask us a question there. Before the break there, we were talking about the risks in ice climbing, and I wanted to talk more about managing the risks. So, Matt, what's your take on that? Must be on your mind a lot as a guide.
Yeah, I mean, it's 24/7, really. Anytime I leave my driveway, I'm managing risk from the beginning. But it's essentially, I define risk as sort of probability and consequence. So what's the probability of something happening to you, and what are the consequences if it does? And it's sort of a dynamic formula. It changes based on the weather and how you're feeling and all these variety of variables. And as far as ice climbing goes, you know, specifically, there are very smart things to do to manage the risk. You know, wearing a helmet from the beginning kind of thing, and just avoiding rockfall, for example, or icefall. If you see it happening near your climb, chances are it's going to continue to happen potentially throughout the day or in the afternoon. So just being observant and being very mindful of where you are in the wilderness and what your consequences are for being there, I think is a huge way to manage risk. And then being proactive at sort of preventing problems from developing and preventing problems from happening just mostly paying attention.
And do you look at it differently when you are out with a client versus on your own?
That's a great question. I might be a little bit more cautious when I'm with a client. I'm definitely a lot more cautious when I'm with a student. But at the same time, I pay attention to the same things. I'm definitely more aware, but I'm probably more professional about my decision making when I'm with students.
And Carl, what about you? How do you manage risks?
I think the best way to manage risk is to pay attention to your experience. And of course, experience is very limited if you're just starting out. Even if a person just starting out has a talent for it and fitness and can move well on steep ground. So those are people that sometimes get in trouble from not falling off a climb, but not paying attention to the fact that they're on a south-facing waterfall and it's a little bit late in the day and an avalanche comes down, or don't realize that some waterfalls are kind of step tiers, and between those steps, often if it's crusty snow in one point and the water's flowing, you get a big slab of ice under the snow that can slab off like a slab avalanche. And I think, you know, there was a climbing shop in Phoenix, Desert Mountain Sports, and their motto once was, there's no substitute for experience, and paying attention to that experience.
And can you give an example of a time where you did get into trouble on a climb?
I think I'll go back to year before last, climbing in Portage, and I wasn't in trouble. But it's a climb that I had always wanted to do. And, you know, I pay homage to Steve Garvey, who did the first ascent of it, an ice climber from here who died rock climbing in the same canyon, Middle Canyon, in Portage, several years ago in 1999. And Genghis is an interesting climb because it has a very difficult early section on the climb that you can protect sometimes. And I tied some icicles off with webbing and, you know, put a little tiny knife blades in a couple of cracks and felt I was secure on the crux section. And it was hard climbing. And above the crux section, the climbing kicks back a little bit. It's maybe 75 degrees. It's not vertical. But the ice was for maybe 100 feet or more. I don't know how far. 150 feet maybe. Somewhere in there. There was no protection. And so it was a situation of, I knew that was probably going to happen when I got on the climb.
There was just no way for you to place protection?
None at all, You know. But the ice was thick enough that my experience allowed me to be very confident that if I just focused on what I was doing, and don't get scared. You know, fear is the mind killer, I think, from a famous Frank Herbert book. And enjoy the moment and relax and pay attention every single moment. It's kind of like biking on the street in Anchorage, that things would work out. And finally, they did. So that was managing the risk in a way that I thought was, I didn't think I was pushing it. And I wasn't.
Okay, and you have another story, though, from Chittistone Canyon. Are you willing to relate that one? You weren't the one on the climb, but...
Yeah, well, I was lucky not to be the one on the climb. My friend Chuck Comstock was on the pitch. It was a long climb, and we all three of us, Chuck and Roman Dial and myself, were on this huge several tiers of waterfalls in Chittistone Canyon way back in the December of 87. And we came over off the top of one pillar, and we saw the next pillar across a little snowfield, and it was wild-looking, and it was free-hanging and barely touched the cone of ice below it. And where it touched, it kind of had a little wiggle, like maybe it wasn't stable, and it really actually had a crack across the top of it. And we so wanted to do this last hard pitch of this climb to finish the climb. That we were sure someone was going to get on it, and it was Chuck's lead, I think, and I was trying to hog it from him, and I'm glad that Chuck hogged it back. So he climbs up this cone of ice where the drips have been making a stalagmite feature. He put an ice screw in the top of that and launched off on the pillar, and Chuck was he was very entertaining to watch climb. He never quite climbed gracefully. You know, his feet would pop off, and he would hang on one of his tools and get back on. And he was doing that kind of climbing on this climb that should have taken a ton of delicacy. But in retrospect, that delicacy might have led him to be a little higher on this pitch. So he was up maybe 10 feet off the cone, and the climb started making these ticking noises, like tick, tick, really loud. Tick. Chuck yelled down, "This climb's talking to me." Or as Chuck would say, "This climb's talking to me." And Roman said, "What's it saying, Chuck?" He said, "It's telling me to get down." And it's pretty hard to down climb ice that's past vertical or even vertical. But Chuck got delicate all of a sudden. He climbed down to his screw. I was taking rope in. As soon as he got down to the screw, I lowered him down to me. And at that moment, the entire pillar collapsed and fell. It would have killed him.
Wow.
But he was told to get down.
By the ice.
By the ice, and that doesn't always happen. Sometimes the ice spits you off. It doesn't care if you're a human being with other wants and needs at all.
So what was the conversation like after that between you guys?
It was, yay-ha, we are so lucky. Let's celebrate that we're alive, and we actually climbed some rock around the pillar just to finish the climb, but it was still unsatisfying. But we knew we'd gotten away with something.
Yeah, and did that change how you climbed after?
Yes, it did. It made me realize that erosion is a big force in nature, and it happens in many ways, and to pay attention to it. And more solid-looking pillars have collapsed on people. So, yeah, it was a lesson well learned with no injury.
And Matt, what about you? Do you have some tales of near misses or accidents that you want to share?
You know, over the years, I've had a few near misses. I've actually seen more accidents from other climbing parties nearby, sort of thing. And really, my job is to avoid that sort of thing altogether. But one that I can think of that's sort of a unique situation that's a little bit of a different situation was a few years ago in Portage Valley, just teaching a multi-pitch class, or actually it was one client teaching a private, and I had a hanging belay, which is basically an anchor system right in the middle of an ice face to sort of show and demonstrate how to keep going up an ice face, and had a hanging belay, and was belaying in my client, and he hit me with his ice tool.
Oh, wow.
And wound up actually chipping my elbow. And so there was a little bit of a drama to get off that climb. I had to lower him down first, and then I had to get myself down. And my elbow swelled up and was bleeding, and it was kind of a painful situation. But it was my mistake for sort of really not seeing that. I mean, we do a lot of management where, you say, this is what, basically just talking people through the moves. And, I just hadn't really quite conveyed to him the importance of not swinging his tool that close to me. Those things happen. And, that was, lucky, I think, in some ways. And ironically that, he didn't hit me harder.
Wow. And, guiding, obviously you're not choosing the clients, they're choosing you. But when you're on your own and you're picking your partners, how much does that play into the risk? And
yeah, that's a huge important factor is, you always want to climb with folks who are on the same page that you're on. I mean, if you're really motivated and psyched to go climb hard, it's important to be with people who are on that same trajectory, physically, mentally, and also the same experience level, because it's just really a really bonding experience, and you really want to be with people who are on the same page.
How about you, Carl?
I agree with Matt a lot on that, the choice of partners. But in the same vein, sometimes, I like occasionally going out with someone who's younger and inexperienced but competent in climbing, and maybe expanding that person's world a little bit, or hopefully expanding that person's world, and maybe they can go on to climb harder things and have a better sense of creativity on that medium. It's good to expose people to that as well.
Is that the teacher in you, because you're a professor, in your work life?
I don't know. I think it's just, I think so-and-so would really, really like this climb. I can see what they're up to and where they're going, and this will be a step in there. It's almost like giving someone a gift as opposed to teaching.
Yeah. Well, we have another caller. Alan has a question. Hello, Alan.
Hello. I know both gentlemen, and as an ex-ice climbing enthusiast, I thought maybe it'd be important to talk a little bit about the physiological demands for this as opposed to, starting biking or skiing or something like that.
Okay, and why are you an ex-ice climber?
Good question. It's an easy answer. A good friend of mine broke his back ice climbing, and I started looking at the sport going, wow, there are a lot more risks in this than many of the other sports that I enjoy. And at the time, as a single man, there weren't many women at all in the sport, and it's like, skiing's going to be more... better to put my time into. So those were my reasons. Potential danger and the minimal people doing it back in the 80s when I started.
Okay. And so, yeah, let's get an answer. Who wants to answer Alan on the fitness required?
Well, Matt? Yeah. Hey, Alan. Matt here. That's a good, really good point, is that it is an activity that's pretty hard on the body, for sure. And, you know, I've got all sorts of chronic, not specific accident injuries, but sort of chronic injuries that come from overuse, like lower back, from the harness. But, you know, I think any climber who's climbing for years, I mean, you do have to cross train. You do have to sort of take care of your body. And, you know, it's just an inevitability of doing the same thing over and over again. And yeah, nowadays, Alan, you'd be surprised how many cute ladies are out ice climbing.
It's changed, huh? Okay, well, let me give out the number another time here so we can get some more callers. If you want to join the conversation, 550-8433 is the number to call in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 outside of Anchorage. My guests are Carl Tobin, who's a pioneering climber in the state, and Matt Sundy, who is an owner and guide at Ascending Path, a guiding service. And Carl, as we've talked about, you've done a lot of first ascents in the state. You were in on climbing very early on. Can you kind of describe, you talked a little bit about starting that process, but what's it like to see something that you want to climb and just decide, nobody's done that, I'm going to do it?
Well, I think a lot of climbers like doing that, you know. It's kind of it's a sport that there's still plenty of first ascents to do, but they're further and further afield. It's a place where it's nice to go someplace where no one has been, even though it might not be as hard as some other things you've done where people have been. You know, pioneering a path is fun. It used to be really casual because there were very few ice climbers in the state, and it was easy to get first ascents. But it can get really competitive sometimes, and that pushes the technical limit sometimes. I think it's good for the sport when there's some competition. Maybe that's why it's called a sport. I'm not sure, but things changed in Valdez after Andrew Embick moved to town, and I knew if I didn't spend a lot more time in Valdez, there weren't going to be too many first ascents to grab.
So when was that?
When did Andrew move to town? I think in 1978.
Okay, wow. So you were down there trying to get as many as you could, kind of thing?
One winter I moved down there for the whole winter, yeah.
Wow. And how many first ascents did you get in that winter?
I'd have to go back and look at Andrew's guidebook, really. But we pushed some hard lines there, Andrew and I, or Andrew and someone else, or me and someone else, and he was a great stimulus to ice climbing and getting locals out down there, because there weren't any locals climbing in Valdez except for Andrew. So, you know, with all due homage to Matt being a guide, Andrew took out some wild characters ice climbing sometimes.
And do you have, like, a most memorable first ascent? I mean, there's so many of them, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I would say it was Bridal Veil Falls in Keystone Canyon.
Okay.
Because of the sort of the cowboy's nature of us when we were down there. None of us had climbed anything that big. I'd climbed some steep things in Banff and, of course, the local Healy climbs. And we drove down there, three of us, a fellow named Cliff Moore and another fellow named Jim Jennings. And we had rules that we had to be back in town for happy hour. And we got late starts because of happy hours, so it took us 3 days to do the first ascent of Bridal Veil Falls because of those rules. But one thing that was in our way was this pillar halfway up, maybe a little more than halfway up the climb. And it was steep, and we didn't have any idea how to place old Chouinard screws on vertical ice. And it came to me to climb that pitch without any protection at all. That was a memorable climb because it could have messed up all of us, and it was just a great feeling at the top of that, walking down in the dark.
Did you make it to happy hour though?
That night, you know, we didn't really care. We sure made it to the bar though.
Yeah.
And how do you know it's a first ascent? I mean, is there a list somewhere, or do you just kind of, is it an oral history?
You know, it is. It can be an oral history, or a guidebook author can be really diligent about, you know, chasing down people about rumors. But in the end, if someone else has climbed it and didn't leave a trace, you don't really know. You know, it's possible that I've never done a first ascent in my life. It's you just sort of weigh the odds and think about, you know, local knowledge and things like that.
And Matt, you've done some first ascents as well, right?
Yeah, earlier in my climbing career, when I was more of a climber than a guide, I traveled a lot and then found some really neat places to go that hadn't been, you know, found some routes that hadn't been climbed before. And specifically one in New Zealand, there's a wall route that I'm pretty excited that I had the chance to go with a really experienced guy who was doing a lot of first ascents in New Zealand. And I happened to be staying in the same backpacker hostel that he was in or something. And we went in and climbed this, you know, 10 pitch wall route in the middle of the Ben Ohau Range in New Zealand. And it was just super fun to be at the base of this giant wall. And there were lots of different lines and options. And I had, at that point in my career, spent a lot of time with my nose in the guidebook a little bit, although at that time I was kind of really not interested in guidebooks because it sort of, in some ways, just going out there and sort of using your judgment, having a sense of where you're going to go, but also spending a lot of effort to figure it out yourself is half the fun, I think, rather than have it all laid out for you. But I got to the base of this route, and you know, it just was a wonderful feeling to have all these options in front of us that were all unclimbed, you know, and we picked a line that was, you know, the proudest, nicest line, and that was definitely the nicest first ascent. Of course, that was rock climbing, but...
And what did you name it?
We named it Eloquent Shadows, because at the bivvy, at the base of the route, the shadows kept sort of dancing as we were trying to figure out the route.
And in terms of ice climbing in Alaska, are there still first ascents to be had? Are you eyeing some, Carl and Matt?
I'm not eyeing any right now, but certainly there are ice climbs that form in the Ruth Gorge and the Kachatnas. If you're there at the right time, people have been jumping on some of those. I'm sure the Brooks Range has a ton of first ascents that no one's ever seen. Mm-hmm. And probably some of the canyons around Valdez, even though people have gone up a lot of the canyons around there, I'm sure there are tons of them there. And the list goes on and on, wherever water will freeze and wherever water will be. And that can vary from year to year to year.
Definitely, yeah. I think access is the biggest issue in Alaska. You know, you need to either ski or walk for days to get to some of these places that haven't seen people in the winter with ice climbing gear on their back, or take a helicopter, or you know, it's just access is the biggest issue. We just don't have a lot of roads like Colorado does.
And are there climbers here who are willing to do that?
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's you know, access is getting easier with better snow machines or better skis and, you know, more affordable helicopters. So it's you know, it's a matter of your commitment level, I think.
Yeah, I think an earlier caller, Clint, he and Scotty Vinchik, maybe 3 years ago or 2 years ago, found a 3,000-foot ice climb in the Revelations. And what a beautiful line it is. You know, never been climbed, and they had a great time on it.
And where is that?
Oh, the Revelations is essentially part of the Alaska Range, quite a ways west of here, around the Stony River and places like that. Out of McGrath.
Okay. Well, we don't have very much time left, but I did want to talk a little bit about gear, because this does seem like a gear-intensive sport. How much gear does it take to get into it? Matt?
The gear is definitely expensive, but once you get the gear, it's free to go climbing. But essentially, the gear that you really need is you need a pair of crampons, you need a pair of ice tools, and you ought to have a rope, and you ought to have a harness, And with those things, you can actually scramble around and get some climbs done. But you really ought to spend time buying a book or hiring an instructor or going with friends who know what they're doing. And I count that as gear, because knowledge is probably the most important, and experience are the most important things that you should have in your backpack or in your brain. But essentially, the gear, the real, you know, the best gear out on the market is expensive, but it's super efficient, and you know, it allows for easier climbing, safer climbing. Helmet is obviously mandatory. So yeah, the gear adds up. But, you know, AMH, REI, there's Craigslist if you really need it.
And, Carl, has it changed a lot in the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's changed a tremendous amount from little weird British sticks that you call pterodactyls, these, you know, little things that were, they were a great little climbing tool, but it was like boxing with a climb. My knuckles are so smashed up from those early climbing days. And no leashes. Leashless tools have opened up climbing a little bit. It gives you more freedom on a climb. And so not having a wrist leash. And a lot of people were, myself included, were a little skeptical of that, because, you know, you support your weight at your wrist with a wrist leash tool. But I find it's less strenuous climbing without those damn leashes on your wrists. And so, yeah, people are always thinking about different designs and ways to make the axes better, the crampons better. The boots have changed tremendously, and they're actually comfortable and light and warm at the same time. Go figure.
Well, that, I think, is about all we have time for. Thanks so much. This has been a great hour. Carl Tobin, pioneering ice climber in Alaska, and Matt Sundy, owner of The Ascending Path. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, we'll have a show on teaching your kids how to downhill ski, which is oftentimes a learning experience for the kids and the parents. I have shared a video of my 2-year-old learning to ski this winter, and we hope you will share some photos and tips for teaching kids to ski on the Outdoor Explorer Facebook page. Join us next week at 2 on KSKA Anchorage, when host Charles Woolforth will be back in the studio. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our producer, and I'm Annie Feit. Happy trails.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.